Ariel Gore with David Beispiel and members of the Attic New Voices about Poetry Northwest, their new national publication, and the New Voices reading at the Blackfish Gallery.
I'm Ariel Gore. I'm here with David Beispiel from The Attic and now from Poetry Northwest as well as four writers who are going to be reading at the New Voices reading tonight at the Blackfish Gallery, Hope Hitchcock, Jacqueline Raphael, William Bernhard, and Luciana Lopez. So thanks for joining me this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks.
So, David, I want to start with you. You are the writer in residence at The Attic, and for folks not in the know, I was hoping you could just tell us what The Attic is all about.
I'd be glad to. The Attic is a literary studio in the Hawthorne District. It's been around since 1999. The primary interest of The Attic is workshops, creative writing workshops. We do classes in screenwriting, in memoir writing, which Ariel teaches, fiction writing, poetry, a time to write class, which is sort of like a drawing class where people come and actually write while they're at the studio. And it's also the place where I do my own work. It's as if you went into a painter's studio and saw all their junk and paint and stuff, and then you also could take a painting class there at the same time. And then once a year we pick a few students who have studied at The Attic for a while and are ready for sort of a public coming out to do a reading, and it's our New Voices reading, and it's tonight at Blackfish Gallery, as you said. It's on Northwest 9th.
Right on. And you also recently relaunched Poetry Northwest.
Yeah, Poetry Northwest is one of the nation's premier literary magazines. It was founded in the late 50s by Carolyn Kaiser in Seattle. And for over 40 years, it was the known as the longest-running poetry-only journal in the United States. It published every major poet in America in the last 40 years, and internationally. It published John Berryman, it published Anne Sexton, published Mary Oliver, published W.S. Merwin, John Hollander, I go on, Stanley Kunitz, Tom Gunn, Philip Larkin, Robert Pinsky, Joy Graham, you name them, they were in there, all alongside unknown or emerging poets in the same issue. The magazine's been out of circulation for about 3 years, 4 years, and it's now published at The Attic. It comes out twice a year. The first issue of the relaunch was in March, and the next one is in October. There's a great staff that's come together to curate the magazine, and it's gotten a lot of press, a lot of attention.
I know, it's been super popular, got good write-ups a lot of places, and you have good distribution around town so people can pick it up.
They can get it at Powell's, they can get it at Broadway Books, they can get it at New Seasons Market, they can get it at Rich's Cigar Shop, I believe. They can get it at most of the bookstores. And
they can they get it tonight at the New Voices reading?
They can get it tonight at the New
right
Voices
on.
Reading.
So one thing that I wanted to give folks a sample of the New Voices reading that's going to be happening tonight by asking all these writers to come and read us just little snippets so that you can get a taste of what's going to be happening tonight, like that. And William Bernhard is going to read first.
Okay, thanks for having me. This first poem I'm going to read is called A Missing Man. Like a darkened scrim, he rose from that bed, hoisted out of himself a missing man. Someone had taken his voice, scooped vacancy into his eyes, walked him into a greening photograph where it is always the same year, reproduced in chemicals, eventually dismantled by light. He gathers in me, red hairs force their way into my brown beard like a shadow huddled inside a shadow. Nerve and bone fold in on themselves, migrate someplace, for which I have no compass, but often remember. This next poem I'm going to read is called The Race to the North Pole. It's inspired by a Swedish explorer, S.A. Andre, who thought he could fly a balloon to the North Pole and was sadly mistaken. The Race to the North Pole. 8 million stitches, all of them leaked. So they dumped their equipment overboard, but the balloon struck the ice floe, dragging death behind. The midnight sun shone, a knife glinting over endless white. They crawled like snow. Most mornings when yanked from sleep, a sliver of dawn taps against windows. Later, when nothing really starts over, a mouse stuck inside lath and plaster walls with wires, nails, and tiny skeletons, I bump my way through this unlit house. The last piece I'm going to read is called 2003, and it's you can think of it as sort of my dream of becoming an expatriate someday. 2003. We spent all afternoon into evening, seated at a small table, pouring ourselves open like wine, or whatever it was that Rembo said. The sun carried itself out of the room like an old man, his woven hat snapped off his head by the wind, somersaulted down the street cramped with houses, their shut eyes closed against pooling heat. We sat at that table till the room went dark, a steady rumble of waves in the ocean's cup, till the room disappeared, spun around like laughter, a promise of morning when iguanas returned to their stones, limbs akimbo, the fishermen ready their nets, drag boats down the shore, and launch into the water's undrinkable sigh.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm listening to William Bernhardt reading some new poems. He'll be reading more tonight at the New Voices reading. You can find out more about the Attic Writers Workshops online at atticwritersworkshop.com. Easy enough. Hopes Hitchcock is going to read next.
Thanks, Ariel. This is a piece from a class that I took with Ariel, and it was called Finding Your Voice, and it's a small excerpt from my book, Moving the Skin. The funeral home director, Don, leads you upstairs past the lobby, past the hushed chapel, down the carpeted halls lined with oil paintings of brooks and meadows, a unicorn even, through the door marked private and into the employees-only section. There's no more carpet. The lighting is no longer dim, and you blink under the new fluorescence. It's loud, and there are people talking and laughing in the next room. There is a dry erase board next to the coat rack. You see a daily chart written in red on the board. You find your dad's name scrawled next to 11 a.m., and another name written below at 1 p.m., the business of death apparently brisk. So this is the refrigeration unit, Don says, pointing to a wall of giant P.O. boxes. And here's your father. Do you want to take a look? He asks. Of course you do. Isn't that why you're here? To soak up every possible morsel and absorb every nuance of this experience with a concentration that suggests you're under the misguided impression that this first death will also be your last. He pulls open the big metal drawer and slides the body onto a gurney. He unzips the clear plastic bag, and there's your dad. One eye is open and one is shut. Don reaches out to close the left eye. No, don't, you say, before you remember to be polite. Your dad's skin is yellow-gray now, and his mouth is gaping open. He is completely gone. You think you should do something romantic, like kiss his forehead or cry, but you feel nothing. You're amazed that he's become a corpse. His presence is completely absent, nowhere even near this body anymore, and that makes you a little sad. After all, you loved this body. Those square hands held yours. Those thin lips kissed you goodnight, and that massive head did your math homework. Don introduces George and leaves to address the needs of other clients waiting downstairs in their dark Sunday best. George is old and wears coveralls. He tells you he's been in this business for 35 years. He wheels the corpse into the very back room of this warren of back rooms. It's a small one, and the massive machine takes up almost all the space. The walls are layered in certifications and instructions, but the print is too tiny to read. This round metal drum is the oven. or as George calls it, the cremation chamber. It's a huge green circle with lights and buttons covering both sides. George answers all your questions, says it takes about 3 hours to burn or finish the body. More if the corpse is obese. George recently had a 700-pounder who took 9 hours and started a chimney fire. Once the body is finished, George sweeps out all the ashes, sifts out the chunks of bone, and puts them down a chute where they get ground up into finer bits. You wonder if George, faithful and trusting as he seems, occasionally sneaks a gold tooth here and there. George tells you he's ready to start, and you remember the other names on the board. He wheels the body over to the chamber. He unzips the plastic all the way down and then off. Your dad is naked under a cream-colored sheet that came from the bed he shared with your mother. George tosses the plastic to the ground. He asks you if you want a minute alone. You don't. You look down at your dad on his cardboard tray. His one green eye stares off past the ceiling of this small room. You are already alone. George opens the giant oven door and slides your dad in with a large paddle. And here, time slows, and then halts. And you know you will always see this moment when you think of today. Old George, time-worn and stooped, sliding your dad into the oven like a baker with his morning loaves.
Thank you. That's Hope Hitchcock reading from A Memoir in Progress. Next, I wanted to ask Jacqueline Raphael to read. Are you going to be, is your piece memoir, fiction?
Kind of memoir.
Fusion,
that's it. Tonight I'll be reading a piece called The Spiral, which is an excerpt from a longer work I'm writing. It's told from the point of view of a 16-year-old girl whose parents recently divorced and whose mother is doing a lot of dating. And the narrator thinks she's pursuing her own boyfriend, but perhaps might be pursuing other things she's not so aware of. The following year, when I turned 16, I found a boyfriend of my own. Peter would drive his parents' station wagon over the state line from New Jersey to Suffern, New York, where the drinking age was lower, to buy a bottle of wine for us to drink in his car. I didn't see Peter often because I had to babysit my brother while my mother went out. When Peter and I were together, I was willing to do things to be his girlfriend. In fact, I wanted to do some things before he did. "You think we should?" Peter asked, after I suggested we have sex. "Yes, soon, anyway. I want to. Don't you?" "Sure," he said, spitting some juice from his chewing tobacco into a plastic Dunkin' Donuts cup. One night that summer, Peter and I stumbled out of the station wagon, a little drunk, to sit in my backyard before my 10 o'clock curfew. We got on the grass, he leaning up against a tree, trunk in an untucked, long-sleeved, button-down shirt, me lying in his arms. I always started by touching Peter's face. Even though acne covered his cheeks, I caressed him, and he shut his eyes and smiled. I closed my own and savored being outdoors, the breeze on my back. The combination of wine and wind and kissing made me feel as if I were floating in outer space. As we kissed, I looked down on myself and my life so far. So many A's and awards, so many summer camp songs and Hebrew school lessons, so many tiny disappointments, like not dancing with boys and not sitting at lunch with the popular girls. Even my black metal microscope, with slides and tiny bottles of stain and a petri dish, the one I had received as a present from my parents at 13, that stayed safe in a box with a small silver lock. I no longer craved the mysteries it had revealed. I'd studied moth wings, drops of blood, and the sleep I'd removed from the corners of my eyes. I imagined all of these things described in a textbook that I'd already read and no longer needed.
Thank you. Jacqueline Raphael and all these other folks will be reading tonight at the Attic New Voices reading at 7:30 at the Blackfish Gallery. Luciana Lopez is going to be reading some fiction for us.
Yes, this is from a short story called Steady that I've been working on off and on for about a year, which actually started from an Attic class last year.
Excellent.
Great. And just to give people the setup, the three main characters are Jacob, who's been in an accident, Sheila, his wife, and his sister, Angela. An hour later, Jacob still hadn't moved. A man in a white coat entered the room. Sheila sat in a chair next to the bed. I think she was crying, but I couldn't see. I sat at the window reading the paper. We'd spoken little since my first few moments in the room. Sheila and I had never talked easily, and now we found speech even harder. The man nodded curtly to Sheila and me, then began examining Jacob. He pulled back the bedsheets and hospital gown, and I saw what the metal of Jacob's car had done. On his abdomen was an ostomy bag, the brown feces inside watery. His penis, small and ugly, was pierced by a tube carrying his urine to another bag. Other tubes had red tinges along their sides, like they were blushing to be so exposed. The man began prodding Jacob here and there, making small notes on a chart. Sheila watched the man, not looking at Jacob's ruined torso. "Who are you?" I said. The man jumped. "I'm Dr. Gregory," he said. I walked quickly over from the window. My heels clicked like chattering teeth. I stopped at Jacob's bedside, across from the man. "Why are you here?" I asked, my hands on Jacob's arm. It was swollen, turgid, around the needle in his forearm, clear tape tying the tube to him. The man stared. "I'm a doctor." "You said that, but what kind? What are you doing to Jacob?" He pulled his white coat closer to his body. "I'm a student of Dr. Nichols, Jake's doctor." "So you're not his doctor?" "No, I told you, that's Dr. Nichols." Sheila said nothing during this. I tried not to look at her. I wondered if the doctor could tell which one of us was the wife. I couldn't even hear her breathe. For a moment, I let myself think that it was only the two of us, only Jacob and me. "Get out," I said. "Look, lady, I need to get out," I repeated. He turned and walked away without another word. I pulled Jacob's gown and sheets back into place, helping him look, under the blankness of the linens, closer to whole.
Wow, thank you. Luciana Lopez, reading from her short story. Steady. Like that, and then David was going to read something from Poetry Northwest, no?
Sure. This is a poem from the first issue. It's by C.K. Williams. It's called Thighs. I should say before I read it about these readings, these New Voices readings, this is the fifth year we've done them, and they're really, really great events. I think the last one we did, there were close to 100 people showed up. Brings a pretty good crowd, so if you're listening and have nothing to do tonight or really want to do something important tonight, come down to Blackfish Gallery and hear some good new writing. Okay, the poem's called Thighs. It's by C.K. Williams. The very great, very tall, truly out of human scale basketball player has been injured, a deep thigh bruise. And all his many fans, including, I admit, me, are worried. How can he play, as he puts it, at 100% when it hurts to walk, not to say leap? If he can't even leap, how can his team not suffer defeat? I leave the sports page, return with reluctance to page one, and read, I couldn't bear to before, a taxi driver in Afghanistan, a small man, 5'2", arrested by mistake, hung by his wrists, and tortured. They don't want to say it, but tortured by blows of his U.S. soldier jailer's knees to his legs, violent blows, countless deep bruising blows, hateful even to think of it, for days, again and again, and his tormentors, instructed to do this, obeyed, because they were given to think this wasn't torture. Torture is something with chains or flame. Torture, they're told, is something people like us don't do. But then the obstinate taxi driver, who'd never confess he'd done anything wrong because he hadn't, did do something wrong, died of blood clots risen to his heart from the crushed arteries in his thighs. His thighs, said the doctor who had done the post-mortem, had been pulpified. Pulpified, like ground meat. This week, with time to rest his injury, a Charlie horse, we called it when I played, it did hurt. The very great player is feeling stronger. I'm at 80% of my game, he reports to the press. And indeed, his team wins in a rout. I don't remember the score, but that's how the paper put it. A rout. That's a poem called Thighs by C.K. Williams.
Thank you. So I have a question for everybody or anybody who wants to answer it. And that is, you've all been in workshops at the Attic. And I want to know, what's the benefit of a workshop? A lot of times we write in isolation. Is it coming together in a community? What are the benefits of being in a workshop? Anybody?
I really appreciated having a due date, having something to look forward to, and to definitely make sure that I had a reading. And I liked the feedback as well. It's really great having so many readers, attentive readers.
The deadline thing is definitely, I sometimes will get into a workshop and the feedback will end up being important, but my main motivation for getting into the workshop is like, I've got to get 10 pages done a week or something like that, and to get into the structure of it.
I think also one of the other benefits is you're with a group of people who are reading, if in my case, poetry. They might be familiar with poets that I haven't read or haven't been exposed to that much. And, some of the assignments are just take you out of yourself, and where, let's say, okay, this week you have to write a villanelle. I mean, I would never think of writing a villanelle on my own, and suddenly I'm forced to in 1 week. So it's just that movement from what you're comfortable with to what you don't know, I think, is important.
Right. That's a good point. Anybody else?
I think having a range of readers or listeners and a chance to ask them questions and find out more about why they feel what they do about your work is wonderful, and you can't get that when you send something out and get it rejected. You don't know why, and that's wonderful.
And I think also it's important to see how different people write things differently. One thing that's always interesting to me is, a teacher will give an assignment to write something, and people will come back with such different perspectives on the work. And it's always good, I think, to see just how different people approach something, and just to see that it's possible to do things maybe in very different ways than you're accustomed to.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for people, I teach there, it's super diverse in terms of people's experience. Listening to these new voices today, these folks have been working on their writing for some time, but I think it's the great thing about the Attic is that there's not like a beginning and an advanced class. You know, there's a diversity of people who are just, picking up a pen for the very first time, out of their journals, to people who have published pretty widely. So it's good that way.
I want to say, too, that the environment of the Attic is really warm and welcoming and cozy, and it's like being in somebody's living room, and that, I think, sets people at ease in a good way.
Right on. Well, with that, we are going to wrap up. I'm Ariel Gore. I've been talking to David Beispiel from The Attic, and New Voices writers Hope Hitchcock, Jacqueline Raphael, Luciana Lopez, and William Bernhard, who will all be reading at the Blackfish Gallery tonight at 7:30. Thanks.